This week on the show, we're talking about how to control your core infrastructure with DNS and what this entails, how the laptop support and usability project goes, an update from the FreeBSD Foundation, FreeBSD at FOSDEM 2025, which has concluded but videos become available soon, uploading a message to an IMAP server using just curl, the death of email forwarding, cruising a VPS at OpenBSD Amsterdam, and more in this week's episode of BSD Now. How quickly a week passes, isn't it great?
It is great. A week has passed all of, a few seconds, but then, now we're in take two. So that was 10 minutes because, my internet's not slow, but I'm sure that the server that this stuff is uploading to is so far away from me, from a latency perspective, I reckon it's 300 milliseconds latency. And that's what takes forever. It's like timing. Everybody else gets to upload their stuff and finished and logged off. And I'm still sitting here in the studio going, waiting. And gotta love that. But anyway, we're here for another show and everybody gets to listen to the how the sausage is made and the secret
sauce. Yeah, the Patreons.
Yes, the Patreons.
That's our appreciation for you providing the financial support for the show to keep it going. And we give you a little bit of a gift to see behind the scenes how, like you said, the sausage is made, the recording is done. And
And if there's something that you want to sort of ask us privately, you can send that to feedback@bsdnl.tv. Say you're a Patreon supporter, and we will discuss it here on the show. And there's other things that we can look at too. So, we can have a pre-show, if somebody wants to have a bit of pre-show conversation with us, we can invite you to the studio to actually... have that conversation, and then it'll be only for Patreon people. So, if you don't want to be interviewed on the full podcast, but you want to sort of just mingle with the other BSD people that are Patreon supporters and the crew here that put the show together, let us know. feedback@bsdnow.tv and see what we can do. But
yep. So there is stuff happening in the mastodons of the world.
Yeah,
in the BSD space.
As I was saying before, we were rudely interrupted by Riverside Studio here, where it decided to say, we've stopped recording now. And I go, oh, great. I've got to wait for the upload before I can refresh the page, because if you don't, the upload breaks and then JT gets all this weird, weird concoction of video and audio, and it's just like, and then he's got a mess to fix up. So we didn't want to make his life hard, though. We're making his life hard now by having a bit
as
of
always,
pressure.
Yeah. Harder than it already is.
Yeah, but anyway, on Mastodon, there was some stuff from Exquisite Social. So that's another Mastodon instance that has got BSD-focused people that are running that instance. And one thing that came across, that they were sort of doing some maintenance, that sort of stuff, and they sort of talked about what they use to run their infrastructure. And one thing that stood out to me was Supervisor D. And I've just gone, Supervisor D. So I did a bit of research. And it's similar to, I won't say System D. It has more representation to OpenRC or init. RC.d that we use in FreeBSD and OpenBSD, but its layout is sort of a bit like YAML sort of layout inside the actual configuration file. And what it does is allows you to launch a process, and then it monitors the process, and if the process dies, it'll actually respawn the process. So it's similar to the service management framework that is in Solaris. So all it does is does one thing really well, and that's manages processes that you ask at the start, and it'll start and stop processes and things like that. Just the same as your service commands do in FreeBSD, but it monitors the process. So if you've got a badly behaving process, so for example, on my Mastodon server, so I run soc.fedytime.com, and that runs Acoma, and the problem with Acoma, it uses Beam in the back end to run the the communication channels to other instances and things like that. And it's got a runner that does the communications, that handles the communication channels into the software, and it does a heap of things. But it actually uses a fair bit of RAM. And one thing I've noticed in my telemetry when I'm monitoring the software is the over time, over weeks, the RAM increases, but you never seem to see the RAM decrease at any point in time. And I thought it was the NGINX doing caching the data, as because that's what you put in front of it to cache data to make it fast for everybody that's using it. I thought that's what was causing the issue, and I was getting out of management, out of memory issues.
Huh.
I thought, I'll fix that. I'll back the cache off on NGINX, and this still didn't fix the issue. And then, because I'm not running with swap either, and I didn't think I'd need to run swap because a lot of this stuff was sitting in the cloud, but I've actually brought it back on-prem because there's more power on-prem, and I found that the amount of bandwidth I needed, I can host it from my basement, not a problem
at all. Sounds like a memory leak of sorts.
Yeah, that's just how Beam works, unfortunately. Okay. Like a bit of research, and it's like I go back a history of 10 years, and there's just like people just talking about Beam for all that long time, and it's just like this is just how Beam works. So I implemented swap. That seemed to alleviate the issue. So then the memory control of Beam and FreeBSD could cooperate, and it could dip into swap. And then it goes, okay, I need to eject some stuff out of RAM. Similar to how ZFS does when your ARC is full and then all of a sudden you need more RAM, FreeBSD then gracefully, pushes a bit into swap as it then, backs off the ZFS ARC to give you more space to actually do stuff. So not only in adding swap to that, I also need to have something that also would prevent Acoma from just stopping and then not starting, and then all of a sudden I go fire up my instance on my phone and go, oh, why isn't my master not? And then I've got to try and find a computer to log in to go and start the instance back up again. Supervisor D fixes all that for me. So now it monitors the process. When it sees it dies, it starts it automatically back up, and I don't have to interact with any. So from an end user perspective, nobody has any idea that if it goes down, and I haven't seen it go down. It seems to manage everything all right. And my monitoring, I should when we eventually have a video feed for Patreons, I'll be able to share some of my telemetry screen in Cacti where you can see the memory consumption of Acoma over the time of when it's running. So
increasing, and then there's a drop.
Yeah, that's usually when the process dies, and then you start the process up, and then it off it goes again. So
it's like the zigzag curve.
It's nice
to watch these and see this is behaving and happening in my system while I was asleep or at crazy o'clock.
Yeah, that's usually when it does. Other times I've seen it get overwhelmed and overrun is where I've posted something, then somebody with a heap of followers retweets it. And what that does is then has all those instances then make a direct call back to my server and then that's where it's like I've seen basically hit bandwidth limit of my connections, like bam, and then Acoma takes it for a while, and then eventually it goes out of memory and just falls over. So but I've only had that happen a couple of times. Now it's pretty well having the swap in place seemed to have fixed a lot of the issues that I was getting. Even as the RAM is consumed, it's only topping out and it's not crashing anymore. So
that's a physical swap or a disk-based swap?
No, just disk-based swap. Like, how when you're doing an install, right? Yeah. Because I was using cloud-based, you're paying for the storage that you're putting, you're using into VPS, right? Mm. So typically as a VPS, you want to just use all your storage. You don't want to just have swap reserved. Right. So say if you've got a 20 gig instance, so you don't want to have 2 gig of that just consumed by swap that just is there and does nothing.
Yeah, it's a waste.
But bringing back home, I've got plenty of storage here. So why not give it swap? And then that fixed the particular issue. So that fixed it for me. Supervisor D is a Python package. You can find it in the ports tree. So it's there in FreeBSD ports. You can load it in.
Isn't there also Watchdog D in the space system where you can say, or is this more for kernel processes?
Yeah. So this works better for this type of use case. Mm-hmm. So
reactivate if something is dying.
And it's separate from the base system. So it's and the configuration's a lot easier, so you can have multiple different, you can use it basically for, if you want to stop using the RC and just use this to actually manage your processes, you can do that. And there's plenty of configuration guides. So, you know, Acoma has configuration guides in their Git tree of how to set up Supervisor D and the configuration that you need to do to actually start that up. And I've also used it for other, I'm using it for everything now that I do.
Yeah, everything supervisored.
Yeah, except for some of the core processes. So SSH and OpenNTPD and those sorts of things. I still use the standard service scripts for that. But for anything that's out of the, I'm not using like so it's out, not using ports tree. So where I'll actually do a Git clone and use the software directly from the repository of the person who writes the code. That's when I will actually use Supervisor D, because usually the RC scripts haven't been written anyway. And Supervisor D is very close to how System D startup stuff works, so that's pretty easy to adapt the startup scripts for Supervisor D. So yeah, something for people to go and check out.
Yeah, a little hint for the admins among us, if they don't have any other means. I mean, this could be an endless loop, checking every time, every second, and then
yeah, I'm not too sure how the underpinnings work within it. You can set log sizes, so you can actually get the log messages when it's starting up, so you can actually debug what's going on, and you can set that, and it has its own log rotation metrics, so you can set like only make the log 15 megabytes, for example, and it'll rotate at that point, sort of thing. So you can you need. So yeah, this, it's very configurable, very adaptable, written in Python, and very low on dependencies. So I highly recommend everybody checking it out.
Okay.
Before we move into the news official headlines, news headlines for the week, last one for the Patreons, is, over on Mastodon again. There was a bit of a conversation earlier this week about LibreSSL, and we sort of started reminiscing Bob Beck giving a talk at BSD CAN back in 2014. So it was like, I remember Bob Beck giving a talk, and then a few of us start and chime in and go, oh yeah, that was 2014, and then, you know, oh, that was on Slashdot. And then we talked a bit more about it, and we talked about, you know, how the slides came about, and it came about with Bob having, you know, he was one of the organizers, so he was on the organizing committee, and there was a gap in the schedule because somebody had to pull out.
Oh, yeah, so, and then they put his talk in there.
So Bob said, I'll come up with a talk. So over beers across the road, and over beers, he slapped the slide deck together. And, the next day he presented LibreSSL, the first 30 days or whatever it was. And I was fortunate to have a video camera at BSD CAN on that one, and I shot the clip and then basically took it back to my room, quickly carved it up and threw it up on YouTube. So it went up as in the Slashdot article as somebody linked to it in the comments, and got slammed on YouTube. So so that link, I did talk about it in the previous episode. Was it the previous? No, the interviews. Yes, the interviews that
BSD CAN for people. Yeah.
Yep. So I talked about it there. So the link that you see in the show notes for the interviews with the BSD organizing committee, we did touch on this talk during that interview, but it was quite a coincidence that it also came up in Mastodon. And I don't know if it's one of the listeners out there that actually did bring it up on Mastodon. And
people listen to us, so
started talking about it. And then we sort of recovered it again from there. So. It was some good stuff happening over there on Mastodon. So highly recommend finding an instance that's suitable for you. I believe our mate Stefano is running BSD Cafe. They're open for sign up. So, you know, if you're looking for a European instance, that's one maybe to go and check out. But there's plenty that have you know, what meets what you want to do. So there's different timelines. You can just have a local timeline of the people that are on your instance, and you can just look at them. Or in my case, there's not that many people on my instance and there's heaps of people I follow. So I get the full world timeline and it's just like the fire hose of Twitter. So yeah, it's a good way of communicating to other BSD folks. So
yeah. And these are some nice little nuggets that people can get through supporting the show and who might not otherwise know about this.
Cool. I think we're good to start on the news headlines. So
Let me do the intro first, and then the JT can do the official cut. BSD Now, episode 599, Core Infrastructure Control, recorded on the 4th of February, 2025. Our show notes still 2024, but we will fix that in post.
This episode of BSD Now is brought to you by Tarsnap. Go to tarsnap.com/BSDNow to find online backup for truly paranoid people. And if you want to support this show in one way or the other, check out our Patreon page at patreon.com/BSDNow. And we thank you in advance for that.
Hi, I'm your host, Benedikt Reuschling.
And I'm Jason Tubner.
Hello, everyone. It's good to have, us back in your ears, I guess, somehow.
Yeah, we didn't go too far since the last recording. In fact, I didn't get out of my chair. So, we just had a bit of a break. We've had a bit of a discussion with our Patreons. So if you're not a Patreon supporter and you want to get in on the pre-show and listen to how the sausage is made, or the secret sauce, should I put it, and some good discussions of what we've been up to during the week, highly recommend joining our Patreon. And you can get in on the action too for an unedited feed and listen to how we do it. That also includes all the stuff ups that we do during recording and how we have to redo things. And you can hear how we carry on that JT just magically edits out of our recordings.
Like it never happened.
Exactly.
Okay, our news roundup is later. Headlines start, as always, at the beginning of the show with, this time, controlling your core infrastructure, DNS.
And yeah, so this is an article over on the Clara Systems. They're prolific bloggers over there, so it's good. That gives us plenty of content that's very relevant to our listeners here on BSD Now. So with DNS, the article starts as Understanding Core Internet Services. Among the many crucial protocols and services that underlie the modern internet, there are two in particular that are typically ignored by sysadmins and enterprises, but offer a lot of reasons to pay attention to them. These services are the Domain Name Service, DNS, and the Network Time Protocol, NTP. Without these, none of the devices under your control could visit a web page or keep time. And I agree, these are two protocols that I enjoy, and everybody says that they have problems with them, and I don't understand the problem. I don't have the problems that they do, so who knows? Maybe it's just how you're doing it. Anyway, back to the article. Almost everyone outsources these services to a motley collection of their ISPs, IoT devices, and commercial operating systems. But there are several reasons to not do this. This article, the first in a two-part series, focuses on taking control of DNS services and benefits it brings to your infrastructure. What is DNS? Domain Name Service, DNS, is an essential protocol that translates human-readable domain names into IP addresses, allowing devices to communicate on the internet. Every packet that flows across the internet is IPv4 or IPv6, but we will simplify the discussion by assuming IPv4 throughout. The first bytes of each of these packets tell the routers of the internet everything that they need to know about the packet. Among this information are two fields that show the packet's origin and destination IP address, each consisting of 4 bytes. It may come as a shock that there is no place nor meaning to address packets with familiar host names like google.com or www.ebay.com in sources or destination fields. Somehow, the IP addresses, and there's plenty of footnotes here, so you'll have to go to the article to read and to refer to the footnotes, must be determined and placed in those packets by your operating system. The service that does this is DNS, and the host that does this for you is a DNS server. No matter how fast your computer and network are, you are not going anywhere on the internet until some DNS server makes this translation for you. You typically have no idea where this DNS server is. It could be thousands of miles away. Who runs it? How did your device even learn about it and know to use it? How many DNS servers are out there? How do they all keep their answers straight? Is there a final authority DNS server to rule them all? Great questions. We'll see them largely answered in what follows. To illustrate how DNS operates in practice, let's example a real-world packet exchange and understand the steps involved in resolving domain names. And there's a packet capture there of the interactions on there. I won't go into it. You'll have to click on the image to get more information. How does DNS work? How does DNS queries and responses work? Classic DNS, which still accounts for most DNS, is a simple call and response service dating back to approximately 1985. The modern incantations of DNS is almost wholly described by the Internet Engineering Task Force, the IETF, in RFC 1034 and RFC 1035. As far as an end user, a client, is concerned, DNS works as followed. A specifically crafted query packet, typically UDP, can be TCP, is sent almost always on port 53 to a known name server. While several different types of information can be requested from a name server, the most basic case is a query from an A record or a quad A record in the case of IPv6, which requests resolution to one or more appropriate IP addresses for the queried domain. The name server will typically reply with one of three cases. First, it may provide the requested A record. Second, it may return a CNAME record, where the server says the domain you queried should be queried under this other name. And third, an error may be returned to explain why the requested record was not provided. For example, in Figure 1, Packet 14 shows the initial query for www.etsy.com. Packet 15 resolves it to a CNAME. Packet 16 is our local system now requesting the resolution for the CNAME. And packet 17 shows four valid IP addresses, any of which may be used by the querying system to reach the site. Note that this exchange took only 18 milliseconds. DNS servers can also return a plethora of other types of records, including MX records for routing mail and relatively free-form text record. DNS servers can also return a plethora of other types of records, including MX records for routing mail and relatively free-form TXT records with a variety of interesting uses. The recursive resolution process. The resolution mechanism itself is typically recursive. That means when you query a name server, the name server, if the answer is not cached, queries an upstream name server, and so on, up to the root of the DNS tree. For most users, the buck stops at the final authoritative root name servers managed by ICANN, physically numbering approximately 2,000 of this writing. In reality, very few queries will ultimately require resolution by a name server, since each recursive host typically has a significant caches of previous provided DNS answers. How to set up and run your own DNS server. Unless you take other steps, the name server's address is typically established dynamically in the secondary information automatically provided during the same initial DHCP configuration in which you received your IP address. If you are behind a NAT router, most people are, it gets DNS name server's information from the Internet Service Provider, ISP, during its own DHCP exchange. The hosts in your network will either receive the same information from your router, or the router will offer to provide its own DNS service to you using that external name server. In either case, you are relying on the provided external name server. These ISP-provided name servers can work adequately, but come with several limitations and potential drawbacks. Why relying on ISP name servers isn't ideal. your ISP can easily monitor and sell information on what sites you visit and what businesses you engage with. You create a lot of unnecessary internet traffic. The ISP may have little incentive to provide a very performant DNS server. For this reason, your overall performance could be limited by potentially poor ISP DNS performance. You fail to take advantage of local LAN-wide caching of DNS lookups. The first two of these are compelling reasons requiring no further explanation. As for the other two performance-related reasons, they are underappreciated. Devices inside of a LAN, an office, or a home are likely to be interested in many of these same sites, and thus many of the same DNS lookups. Therefore, it makes a great deal of sense for a LAN to have a shared universal DNS cache for its hosts, against which queries are resolved in just a few milliseconds and involve little or no internet traffic. Choosing DNS software for your DNS server setup. Fortunately, running your own caching recursive DNS servers for a home or small office requires no special technology mastery and is so lightweight that you're likely to be quite hard-pressed to measure any load. In what follows, we explain how this might be accomplished on FreeBSD, though the software mentioned and techniques and considerations could apply to all server operating systems equally. As you would imagine, there are several well-regarded pieces of software that provide DNS functionality. An exhaustive comparison of these are beyond the scope of this article. As of this writing, the FreeBSD projects or the ports tree contains 241 DNS-related software packages in the DNS directory, many of which are fully-fledged DNS servers, ranging from extremely lightweight and basic to the most Byzantine and matron-only options for a DNS server setup. The software that the FreeBSD project has adopted as its default DNS resolver, offering a good balance between capability and performance, is Unbound. It can be installed with the default options via pkg install dns/unbound. Alternatively, installing this DNS server via ports offers several advantages to the more advanced users. These include options to build with or without threading, with and without advanced event handlers, and enabled various plugin support. As a result, this provides flexibility for tailoring your DNS server setup for your specific needs. The article goes further into the configuration of Unbound, but we will move to the key takeaways. Taking control of your DNS server can transform your network's efficiency, security, and flexibility. Key insights include unmatched performance. The local caching eliminates delays, ensuring near instantaneous DNS resolution for frequent accessed domains. Enhanced privacy. By avoiding DNS provided servers, you keep sensitive browsing data within your control, reducing exposure to tracking. And purpose-built configurations. Tailor DNS functionality to suit your network's unique demands, from custom forwarders to advanced caching strategies. Self-hosting a DNS server isn't just about control, it's about building a robust foundation for your network. So let's just look back on this article. So I don't know about you, Benedict, but I do run my own Unbound instance here at home. So I on my OpenBSD firewall, I run Unbound and NSD. So NSD is used for my primary zone for my internal domain. So I have my external domain, then I run an internal instance of that. So I don't have to do a split horizon. I do proper delegation. So that's running NSD. But for my resolution, I use Unbound. So it has conditional clauses with inside the configuration. So if it's, I hit my internal one, it'll transfer the query directly to the NSD socket to actually resolve that and then provide that back, and Unbound provides that back to me. But if it's not something that's hosted internally, then I actually have it hooked up. So it actually does a TLS call out to Quad 9. So Quad 9 is a privacy focused upstream DNS provider. And then that does the query out to the internet. So it improves the privacy because you're using DNS over TLS. which gives you, you know, your ISP will not see it. It makes the direct connection to Quad9, but Quad9 will obviously see that request.
Yeah.
But it means that then you've got no interruption and you know that the DNS lookup is being done by that remote server that has
there's no changing in between.
Redundancy in place and all the bits and pieces and privacy and no tracking and things like that. Because, you know, if even if you use your own unbound address or server and then you do the resolution yourself back to the root zones, it's typically going to be doing that call using unprotected protocols, using UDP and TCP on port 53. So your ISP is still going to be able to see that traffic because it's not encrypted between one point to the other point. So, you know, DNS over TLS, while it's not perfect, it's a good compromise to improve your DNS security.
Yeah. That could be an article all by itself, how to set this up.
But oh, don't give me ideas. I've already got us in trouble for enough articles.
Okay, then let's postpone it. Or maybe someone from the community has written this up already and hasn't supplied it yet to the show at feedback@bsdnow.tv, and we'll be happy to cover that then. Yeah. But if it doesn't reach us, then we
like covering your articles. We don't like reading our own articles, so please write articles
and then we can
read them out for you.
Speaking of other articles, we have updates from the FreeBSD Foundation's blog about the laptop support and usability project. So they have a first monthly report and community initiatives update for us. So remember, the FreeBSD Foundation's laptop support and usability project is in full swing, they say, and staying updated has never been easier. The first monthly report is now available. That's a separate link, and the highlights they show include graphics drivers. New documentation now provides clear guidance for developers using or updating DRM drivers from Linux to FreeBSD, fostering broader community support. And the next focus is to update the graphics drivers incrementally through newer Linux versions, eventually reaching Linux kernel 6.12. Then there's Intel Wi-Fi driver proof of concept. A lot of people have been waiting for this. Proof of concept IWX driver for Intel Wi-Fi imported from OpenBSD via Haiku has successfully achieved network association and full 802.11 A, B, and G functionality. January's focus will be on enabling HT rates and preparing for wider testing. So that's good news. A lot of people should test this and report back so that they shake out some of the flaws that may still be in there. Then there's graphics drivers. Linux 6.7 porting, the DRM driver code from Linux 6.7 has been ported to DRM Kmod with successful i915 and AMD GPU testing. Also good to hear that. A persistent i915 display bug is set to be addressed in January before upstream submission. Okay, they are working on that. The full report contains progress updates on supported laptop models, desktop environments, and technical network. So more details about the project can be found in the GitHub repo. In parallel to that, the community-led desktop working group, also abbreviated to LDWG, also known as Ludwig, launched in December. So led by Chris Mertz, the project focused on the following: encouraging contributions by developers, testers, and industry experts to enhance the usability of FreeBSD on laptops and desktops, facilitating collaboration through code contributions, testing initiatives, operational support, and hardware insights. Then they're supporting the creation, validation, prioritization, and delivery of user stories identified in the Foundation's laptop support and usability project that we just covered, and creating content such as recordings, articles, tutorials, documentation, and system configurations for those interested in FreeBSD on laptops and desktops that we can then later cover on BSD Now. Minutes from the first two meetings, along with details on how to get involved, can be found on the wiki. Videos are also available on the FreeBSD Project YouTube channel, so that these are the meeting recordings for the people who couldn't make those but still want to see what's been discussed or how this went. A huge thank you to Chris Mertz for leading this initiative. The Foundation is excited to see the FreeBSD community come together on this effort and looks forward to the great progress ahead. Yeah, that's good. And see, a lot of people coming together in the community can make changes like this happen.
Yeah, it's really good to see. I sort of touched on this particular initiative on the previous episode, and you can go back and listen to that if you haven't already listened to it. But it's the YouTube channel is where everything's at. So, you know, during your lunch break, you can kick back and watch. If you can't participate in the special interest group, which this is the SIG, you can actually catch up. It's a very open meeting. So there's nothing, you know, secretly talked about. It's very, very open. So everybody can see the progress that's happening with this special interest group. So highly recommend going checking it out. It's the way I can actually participate because the meeting's on at a very non-palatable time zone for me. So I can't participate in it, even though I'd like to. Yeah. Yeah, you can always catch up after the event. So go and check it out.
And running into the news roundup this week, we just finished here in Europe the FOSDEM conference, and a couple of BSD people were there, including our own Tom Jones. And this is still the announcement for it on the FreeBSD Foundation's website. And since this has already happened, maybe some of the recordings are already there because they had a dev room there. But
yeah, I think they're still trying to get the recordings up. I'm not sure what's happening there, but
By the time this episode comes out, I guess this will be available sooner rather than later.
So we'll read the foundation's announcement out. So January 27, 2025, heading to FOSDEM 2025. Be sure to stop by the FreeBSD stand in Building K to connect with contributors, learn about the latest updates, and grab some cool swag. I believe Tom was manning that booth for a bit there, so. Hopefully you got to see Tom and meeting him in person because we didn't get to see him at Euro. He was off busy doing stuff. So, you would have got to see him here at FOSDEM. But anyway, the team will be available to answer questions and share insights about the FreeBSD project. The FreeBSD talks at the BSD Dev Room consists of taking place on Saturday, February 1. So the focus talks were for half an hour each. And it was FreeBSD security audits have improved our security culture. Wake up FreeBSD, implementing modern standby with SOIX and a packets journey through PF. And then also saw writing about FreeBSD, which was Tom Jones, the speaker. So, yeah, he presented in the dev room, and FreeBSD audit source and other Syslog NG news. So Syslog NG, that's another conversation I was having with Mastodon the other day. It's just like somebody was asking for log aggregators, and, we put Syslog NG under some pretty heavy load in the office. And, I highly recommend if anybody needs to do log aggregation for any technology. Yeah, Syslog NG can just slurp that stuff up, not bat an eyelid. So highly recommend that. Back to the article, why I attend. This is a great opportunity to deepen your FreeBSD knowledge, meet fellow enthusiasts, and gain insights from experts. So don't miss it. But if you did miss this year's, maybe next year you should go to FOSDEM. And there's talk, like there's a few of us would like to see, you know, a FOSDEM, an Asia FOSDEM. So, you know, hey, everybody, somebody wants to organize something, can you get that off the ground too? Because that would be a great complement to Asia BSDCon. So for the Asia quadrant of the planet, we can get to another conference and hook up and network with everyone. So yeah, if you didn't get the FOSDEM this year, put it in your diary for next year, and hopefully the team can see you there.
Yeah. And again, the recordings will be there for the people who couldn't actually make it but still want to follow along, so that they can see what has been discussed. And I guess some of these talks will also be presented at other conferences, at BSD specific ones, I guess. So we will be happy to watch them live as well.
Yeah, I reckon we might see some of those ones we saw there appear at a BSD Can, I reckon.
Yeah, that would be a great thing too. And we can heckle Tom now that we have seen his talk. We're not too bad at hecklings.
No, we just like giving Tom heaps.
A bad time. No, it's good that he was there, that he manned the staff or manned the table, gave a talk, and talked to a bunch of people there. I'm fairly sure he will have plenty to talk about next time he and I will record. Switching to Jan-Piet Mens' blog, who keeps putting out good stuff, so we might as well cover it and increase his reach. This one is about uploading a message to an IMAP server using curl. And it starts with, on one of the long drives during my tour to the south of France last week, I was listening to Daniel Stenberg, aka Bagder, so Badger with D and G switched around. That talk was about curl on episode 808 on Floss Weekly. And at one point I began wondering what the Swedish national alcoholic beverage might be. The reason, you see, is that Daniel mentioned curl could upload mail to an IMAP server. Yeah, right. So he has a shell example here, cat test. So this is just test txt with a from colon jp subject, like an email would look like, and a little bit of a subject line, a quick brown fox jumps over the lazy dog, and then he runs curl dash lowercase s uppercase s lowercase f dash dash user, and then dollar u colon dollar p, so user and password, dash dash url, then the IMAP's address slash inbox, and then dash dash upload dash file test txt. As you might imagine, u, p, and h contain the username, password, and host name for my IMAP server respectively. And see there, he runs that thing, and he, I guess this is mutt or something. I still need to get into that. One of my to-do lists is reminding me to start learning that. So here is the output. That is just exactly like the text said, and the subject is also there, as well as the content itself. The message deposited with the backslash scene flag, but there's already a to-do, upload unread proposal. Somebody needs to do it. There's also an example IMAP append D, which shows how to deposit mail using libcurl's IMAP capabilities. A new curl was full of support for strange protocols, surprises, like MQTT, but this one had slipped by me. So now people can also run texts directly into their IMAP servers.
Well, this is one that come out of left of field. I didn't expect to see curl being able to be slammed in this sort of way to try and achieve this, but here you go. Seeing curl do something else weird. Wow.
That would be, good to know. I mean, for your Unix toolbox, it's always good to have these tricks available in case you need them.
Yeah. Hey, I just noticed on his blog that up the top, I see a green IPv6. Do you see a green IPv6?
It's
up near the RSS symbol.
Oh, yeah, it's there. Yeah.
Just so you've got IPv6.
Great. I feel so powerful now. I'm so compatible with the future internet.
I can't get over the resistance that people have with moving to IPv6. And when I see blogs with this that do a detection to show
this
is a person that really appreciates, modern technology and where we should be, not where we should be heading, where we should be by now. So well done. Full marks on that blog. Next on the news roundup, we have another blog post on mythicalbeast.com. So the death of email forwarding. Yes, there is a big death of email forwarding. You won't be able to, I'm surprised you're still getting away with it if you're doing it. But if you're not doing it, don't think about doing it. Just have it fetch with an IMAP fetch or a POP fetch or whatever sort of thing. Don't try and forward it. It's just a world of pain and you'll end up on blacklists and stuff like that. Anyway, we'll get back to this blog. From the January 29th, 2025, a history lesson. Back in the mists of time, not that long ago, you could happily forward email to another account, sending all your email to a single mailbox and replying through your internet service provider's SMTP server with whatever addresses you wanted as the sender. Unfortunately, back in the 1970s, someone realized you could send the new fancy electronic mail to people you didn't know. A few hundred users were affected, were rather negative about it, and it didn't really catch on. But within a couple of decades, the ARPANET became the internet, and unsolicited email started to become annoying. With the information superhighway appearing in the mid-90s and the growth of personal computers, the internet started to grow rapidly, and spamming, term adopted from Usenet, became more common. Blacklists and whitelists were developed with lists of unknown spammers, email addresses, and IPs, which were known to send spam. But the fact is that email addresses could be trivially faked, and there were always other servers to send email through. Over the years, there's been various different approaches to authenticating email senders, but it's a continual arms race. Spam remains the problem, as does the plethora of scams and frauds that are enabled by the ease of which email can be forged. SPF and SRS. In the early 2000s, the Sender Policy Framework, SPF, started to gain traction. SPF works by publishing a DNS record in text, similar to what we were talking about earlier, that declares which services are allowed to send email from your domain. Unfortunately, SPF had two fatal flaws. Pretty much by design, it breaks email forwarding. You can't, for example, use our servers to simply forward email to your Gmail account because our servers aren't allowed to send mail from the origin's sender domain. SPF restricts the envelope sender, which is the hidden address that bounces messages and gets sent to. The one that users actually see in their mail client, the from address, is still unrestricted. One could be fixed by another three-letter acronym, SRS, or Sender Rewriting Scheme, as the name suggests. This replaces the original sender address with a different address in your own domain, and because this sender is usually hidden, the receiver mail looks no different. We've supported SRS forwarding on our servers for a long time, and until recently, it worked well. Two was a tricky problem, which we had to come back to. DKIM. In the 2010s, and with processing becoming cheaper, Domain Keys Identified Mail, DKIM, also appeared, which electronically signs the mail so that the remote server can verify the signature. The public keys are published in the sender's domain DNS, again using text records, so recipients can verify that the mail came from the claimed sender. DMARC. The issues with DKIM is that it's not universally adopted. So whilst you can check if a signed mail is legitimate, you can't assume that its unsigned email isn't. Enter yet another acronym, DMARC. The Domain-Based Message Authentication Reporting and Conformance, DMARC allows a domain owner to publish yet another DNS record, using text, which says all my mail will either be DKIM signed or pass SPF or both, and if it hasn't, bin it. Adoption of DMARC has been slow, not helped by the fact that publishing a strict DMARC policy in 2014 broke just about every mailing list of the time. Fast forward 10 years, mailing lists have learned to adapt, and the big mail providers are pushing the world towards DMARC. Gmail, probably the largest free email provider, now requires either SPF or DKIM to be enabled on the domain in order for them to be accepted from any mail from it. And if you're sending bulk email, you need to have a DMARC record too. The effect on forwarding mail. While these measures have all helped greatly to combat spam, with a large proportion of it now coming from compromised servers or mailboxes, it's had some downsides, the most obvious, which is the difficulty in forwarding email. Lots of our customers like to register a domain with us, set up some email addresses in that domain, forward them to their existing email accounts at other providers such as Gmail or Yahoo. We also host lots of clubs and other organizations that have role-based addresses like treasurer@myclub.org, which forward to the person currently doing that role, and the mail expanders like committee@myclub.org that forward to a handful of people. DMARC alignment. SPF is now widely adopted, and as noted above, you used to be able to work around the issue that it creates for forwarding using SRS. But one of the subtle features of DMARC is that it quite quietly fixes problems too with SPF. In order to pass SPF in a way that makes DMARC happy, the hidden sender address that SPF restricts has to be in the same domain as the visible from address. This is called alignment. If you forward without SRS, the messages that you forward will fail an SPF check. If you forward with SRS, the messages will technically pass SPF, but DMARC will call it a fail because the sender and from addresses do not match. In other words, there is no way to pass DMARC check using SPF when forwarding mail. You have to rely on DKIM and hope the forwarding mail with or without SRS, doesn't break DKIM. You would hope that senders wouldn't publish a strict DMARC policy without first ensuring that all other outbound mail is DKIM signed, but you may be disappointed with mail providers increasingly enforcing DMARC policies. Mail forwarding has become less and less reliable. Yet another acronym, ARC, promises to fix mail forwarding, but is not a magic bullet. We'll discuss that another time. Of course, forwarding mail works fine if you're in control of the server you're forwarding to and can whitelist the server doing the forwarding, but that's not common. Most people want to forward to providers like Gmail where they have no such control. For some platforms, there is a workaround. Rather than forwarding email, have the platform collect it from a mailbox using POP3 or IMAP. For example, Gmail have their check messages from another account functionality in their mailboxes, which picks up your mail from another mailbox as if it's being received by Gmail mailbox directly, and other platforms are adding similar options. This works well enough for personal email addresses, but it's a lot more hassle for things like role-based addresses at emails at clubs and societies, and doesn't work at all for mail expanders where multiple recipients need to collect the mail. This is why we can't have nice things. So yeah, this is a problem, and the use cases are very valid here. But unfortunately, spam has just, you know, destroyed things, and we can't have nice things, so we have to use these things. But I run my own mail server, and I have no delivery issues because, you know, I take all these things into consideration. I have DKIM set up properly. I have SPF set up properly. So when I send a mail from my mail server or anybody that uses my mail server, it exactly lands in the important email inside Gmail, so I don't hit any of their blocks or anything like that. So it's a good use case. So, you know, following proper hygiene, mail hygiene, will make sure that your mail will get delivered correctly. And Michael W. Lucas, give another plug to his book, has got that well defined. He's got some good sections there around DKIM and DMARC, and a lot of the modern blog posts around configuring mail servers using things like OpenSMTPD. Also have well-documented implementations of how to set those things up with SpamD and the different components like Dovecot and that sort of stuff to be able to sign your email on its way out mail server. So
yeah play nice.
It is what it is, but unfortunately there's nothing we can do about it, but play the game.
All right. Yeah. So now we're cruising over to a VPS at OpenBSD Amsterdam. That's what the article on our favorite unpronounceable blog says. This is a description of how you get an OpenBSD Amsterdam VPS. And it starts, when it comes to getting an OpenBSD virtual machine, you can go to your preferred Linux VPS provider and hack its resource mode to install OpenBSD. Or you can go to a VPS provider that offers booting from an ISO file and getting access to the console. In that case, you'd probably get an OpenBSD VM running on KVM, which is not that bad. But you can also book your VM from OpenBSD Amsterdam and let the 100% OpenBSD journey begin. So what is OpenBSD Amsterdam? It is a VPS provider that only offers OpenBSD virtual machines. It is unique in that the entire virtualization infrastructure runs on OpenBSD itself. They have physical servers running OpenBSD with VMM, VMD. Those hypervisors host the VPS you book from them. Because of this, the VPS have fairly static configuration. You get one CPU vServer with 1 GB of RAM and 50 GB of storage for roughly €5 per month as of December 2024. There are options to book a bit more memory and or storage if you really need more. The purchase is done on a yearly basis, and each time you book a VM at OpenBSD Amsterdam, they donate a portion to the VPS pricing to the OpenBSD Foundation itself, so a nice way of contributing back. There's details about this. They link to openbsd.amsterdam, of course, and this website and email services are actually running and hosted at OpenBSD Amsterdam. I own another VM that does some monitoring stuff. I also booked another one to actually proof test all the stuff you'll read in the following sections. When done, this VM will be reused to another project I have in mind. So definitely quite good to have. Book your VM. If you're already on OpenBSD Amsterdam homepage, click the Book VM yellow button or simply browse to the Book Your VM webpage. Read the terms of service and think twice before running your 5 million $1 enterprise ERP on those VPSs. I booked my first VM in January 2020 and only encountered one big issue where the VM was totally lost because of hardware error. There was regular here once every 6 months downtimes that never exceeded an hour when the hypervisors were upgraded, and there may be some shorter downtimes like 5 to 10 minutes when a security patch requires a host to be rebooted. Okay. Then you fill in the booking form. I skipped that because that's fairly standard. Then you confirm after filling that out that you're a real human by validating the captcha. Then click the yellow book it button and the process starts. Greetings and payments. Once the booking is processed and the VPS is ready to roll out, you get a notification email. It contains all the information required to connect to the VPS itself and to the hosting hypervisor if you need to access the VPS console. Both accesses are done using the username and SSH key you provided during booking, so you already securely connect to your own server by running your own SSH key and keeping that private. Here's an anonymized example of the welcome email you get with your VPS. That's basically welcome, thanks for joining, your IP address, the subnet, the gateway, and of course these are all blurred out so you don't see actual IPs and host names and things like that, so that you have a better idea how this will look like. And also they repeat the payment for the year, which is $67 here, euros, sorry. Already converted that. Once your payment is done, you can start connecting to the virtual machine, the VPS access. There are two main ways to access the virtual machine, either connecting to its SSH daemon or connecting to the host server using SSH and accessing the VPS serial console. So these are well described in a separate article. Then connecting using SSH, that's fairly easy. You do SSH minus I, provide the key that you used to username at hostname that you got from the email, and then you are getting logged in. The randomly generated root password is stored in the last field of the user's authorized keys file. Display it, switch to the root user, and proceed to your preferred administrative tasks. So now you're in control of your VPS machine. Note that the password is also the one preconfigured for your user. You probably want to change it too, just for security, and that makes sense to do. Accessing the VPS console. If you ever lock yourself out of the VM, wrong PF rule, system crash, network down, whatever, or require entering the password to unlock your encrypted boot disk, you can access the VM console. Connect to the host via SSH and use vmctl, and they have a small example for that too. And when they only need to access the console to enter the FDE password or boot or monitor a reboot, I tend to use a command such as SSH minus lowercase t, capital I, the key, username at the host, dash lowercase p, change me, the password, and then vmctl console vm, the VM number. Extra OpenBSD Amsterdam services are reverse DNS for your VPS's IP. And OpenBSD Amsterdam also offers additional free storage to achieve backups. You typically or basically get a dedicated SSH access to the backup server storage and can export your local VPS files using a dedicated user and an SSH connection. They have a section on reinstalling it. Hopefully you don't need that very often. But in case you need to, you have the instructions here to prepare. If you have wrecked your VPS so badly that you can't even boot it, you can still reinstall it using vmctl, log into the host and download the OpenBSD installation kernel image, then use vmctl to boot from that and run the installer as usual and provided your preferred settings. Don't forget to delete the bsd.rd file when you're done. You're not supposed to store things in your home folder. And last but not least, you can now book your VM at OpenBSD Amsterdam and have fun with it. Cool. Very nice service.
BSD Now is sponsored by Tarsnap. Everyone needs backups, and Tarsnap ensures that your backups are not only safe, but also secure. Your data is encrypted on your device before being sent to the cloud. You can be sure that only you have the ability to read your data. Tarsnap takes your data and works out what is duplicated. It then assembles the data into compressed blocks and encrypts them with your local private key. And this key never leaves your system. The data is then uploaded into the cloud. Even if someone is able to obtain your data in the cloud, they will not be able to decrypt it and access your files. Tarsnap is easy to use. If you can use Tar, then you can use Tarsnap. Tarsnap is prepaid, so you never have to worry about an unexpected bill. Tarsnap is fully open source, allowing you to inspect the code and make sure it does what we say it does. And Tarsnap has bug bounties so that if you find errors in the code, you can get paid for helping make the software better. With clients on all major platforms, there's no excuse not to have good backups. Go to tarsnap.com to learn more.
And with that, I think we have given you the weekly BSD update that you were so desperately needed. Plenty of stuff here and there, good developments happening, and VPS options as well. So check those out. And like always, we'll be back with another episode next week. With a 600 and one, actually.
Yes. Yes. Aha. Yes, because we're at the 599 today. So ooh, 600. Exciting. So we've got something installed for you. So make sure you tune in for number 600. But if you want to get back to us to give us some feedback or some tips on the show, or if you've got a blog that you wish to promote, hit us up at feedback@bsdnow.tv, or come and join us on the Telegram channel, t.me/bsdnow. All the details are in the description of the podcast, and you can come and join and chat with other like-minded BSD people. But until next week, I've been Jason Tubner.
And I've been Eddie Koeschling.
Catch you later.